You may know Beth Howard as the Pie Lady, who used to live in the American Gothic House. But before she moved into an Iowa historic landmark, she fell in love, got married, and moved 6,000 miles to Stuttgart, Germany. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk with Beth Howard about her latest memoir, Hausfrau Honeymoon, Love, Language, and Other Misadventures in Germany. It tells the story before the story she told in her popular memoir, Making Peace. Then later in the hour, Rich Bowens has been working as a cobbler for 70 years. He's owned Smitty's Shoe Repair in Marion for the last 35, and this week, he's closing his doors. I'll talk with him. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, Rich Bowens is retiring after 71 years of repairing shoes. I will talk with him. But first, Beth Howard has been on this program many times. In 2012, she published a memoir called Making Peace, a memoir of love, loss, and pie. She also lived in the American Gothic House, ran the Pitchfork Pie Stand, and taught pie lessons. She now lives in a little quieter location, and she's just released a memoir about the story that came before the story she told in Making Peace. It's a story of love, marriage, and culture shock. The title is Hausfrau Honeymoon, Love, Language, and Other Misadventures in Germany. And Beth is here with me now. Hello, Beth.
Hi, Charity. It's great to be back.
It's wonderful to have you here. And I think a lot of people are familiar with the story that you told in Making Peace, which happens after this story. And it means that we know that this story doesn't have a happy ending. What made you want to go back and explore your relationship with your husband, Marcus, and to share this story?
Well, I didn't actually want to go back and share this particular story. But what happened is I wrote my memoir about my 4 years living in the American Gothic House, and I submitted it to a publisher in New York City who had requested it. And then I was looking around going, OK, now what? And author's advice is during the submission process, you start the next book. And I'm like, no way. I just worked so hard getting this one out the door. I don't have the energy to start a new one. But then I realized, hey, wait a second, I have this finished manuscript that's been sitting in my files for 12 years. And I thought, well, this would be a great opportunity to revisit that. And I hadn't even read the manuscript in 10 years.
Wow. So you wrote this book well before you wrote any of the other books that we've read.
Yes, my first full-length manuscript.
What was it like to pull that out of the drawer and read it?
Well, I was surprised at how good it was.
That's a lovely feeling.
That sounds really vain, but I'm just saying that I thought it was really funny in parts. It helped me relive an experience that was quite difficult at that time, but it also helped me see the humor in it, because a lot of the story is actually pretty funny. I sort of, make fun of just how outrageous some of the experiences were. So, and it just, of course, made me miss my husband. I will say that it made me remember why I loved him. And it also reminded me of the difficult things that we went through. But it also reminded me that we did both try so very, very hard. And there's just nothing I can regret. And you're right, it doesn't have a happy ending. I don't reveal that in this particular book, though. I just say at the end, if you want to know the rest, it took 320 pages to tell the rest of that story. So go read Making Peace.
Let's talk about Marcus. So Marcus was German, and the two of you met in the most unusual and just happenstance way. It sounds like the beginning of a fairy tale, but tell me how the two of you met.
I was in Oregon on a sort of soul-searching trip looking for maybe possibly a new place to live, and someone had said, go check out Bend, Oregon. And on my way to Bend, I saw this national monument sign for Crater Lake National Park. And at the last second, I'm like, okay, I'm just going to go check out the park. I've never been there. And in the Crater Lake Park, the lodge, Crater Lake Lodge, I met Marcus. He was there having dinner. I was there having dinner. We crossed paths in the lobby. I think he'd been eyeing me throughout the evening, but we finally started talking in the lobby. I talked to him maybe 15 minutes and gave him my card, and And 18 months later, I was moving to Germany to marry him.
So you really, that encounter, there was clearly an immediate attraction, but you really didn't think you were ever going to hear from him again, did you?
No, I didn't.
So how did you hear from him?
Well, he had emailed me, and I was no longer in Oregon, and he was he had been working in Portland for about 3 months, I guess, but I had gone back to California, decided I wasn't going to be moving to Oregon. He emailed me, said it was great to meet, and if I ever wanted to meet for a drink, great. Well, I ended up moving to Seattle about, 2 months later, and so then I contacted him, and I said, okay, well, I can meet for that drink. I'm just up the road in Seattle, and he said, no, I'm back in Germany. So that was that, and then a few months later, he called me out of the blue, and I just said, well, I happen to be coming to Europe in a few weeks for a friend's wedding. And he said, well, come see me in Stuttgart. And I said, come see me in Tuscany. So, yeah, he met me at the Milan airport and picked me up on his motorcycle. And off we went to my friend's wedding at this beautiful villa in Tuscany. That was definitely a romantic start to the story.
Well, and during that time, I mean, you obviously had that instant connection when you met. During that time of exchanging emails, did you get to know each other, or was that kind of almost a blind date in Tuscany?
Yeah, I would call it more of a blind date. That's definitely a risk, but I figured I was going to my friend's wedding. I had an out. I had nothing to lose. I could, have dinner with him in Milan. And then if it was going to be a no-go, we were only going to meet for like a day.
Right.
And then we really liked each other. So then I was like, oh, do you want to come with me to my friend's wedding? And he had brought a suit just in case. So he must have had an inkling. So he came to the wedding. He ended up staying with me for 10 days. And then after the wedding, I was going to fly back to Seattle, but instead I went to Stuttgart and extended my trip by another week. So I got to go there and meet his family and see where he lived. And then it just kept going from there, right, because his company kept sending him back to Portland for work. And I was still in Seattle at that time. So we were able to see quite a bit of each other.
But it was very much a long-distance relationship. How did you get to know each other over those times, in between those, weekends or week-long opportunities to be together?
Germans get a lot of vacation. So he had a 4-week vacation, and he took the whole thing with me in Seattle. And that's part of the story, how he would come over and drive me to work, and he would do my dishes for me. He would cook for me, shop for me. I'm like, oh, this is a catch. This is guys, going to be my housewife. And yeah, then that didn't quite work out the same when I moved over there. It was like, oh no, he didn't do any dishes or do shopping. He expected me to do all that when I moved over there. So that was a harsh reality about our courtship. It was like, wait a second, you're one guy when you're in the U.S. and then you turn into this other guy when you're back in your home country.
Right. So when you decided to get married, I mean, his job really kept him tied to Germany at that point. If he wanted to continue with his career track, and things were going very well for him, so it was in everybody's best interest for him to keep going, you knew that you needed to live in Stuttgart, Germany for at least 2 years. That was the agreement.
Well, and he worked for Daimler, which they make Mercedes-Benz, and they're a global company. So I thought, well, this is pretty cool. I have an international mindset. We could live anywhere in the world. How exciting is that? But I hadn't factored in how hard it would be, being in Germany, trying to learn the language, trying to fit into his culture.
And you had lived all over the world, so you're somebody who loves to live in different cultures. Tell me a little bit about moving to Germany and some of the culture shock that you experienced. I mean, for one thing, you were not fluent in the language, so learning the language was your number one priority, and that proved to be really challenging for you, right?
It was painful. I still panic even thinking about having to read out of my book if there's a German word in there. It's like, oh, I'm not going to say it right. Yeah, it was a really hard language for me. It just didn't feel natural. I did study it for a month in Seattle before I moved to Germany. And then once I got to Germany, I was in immersive classes, like intensive 5 hours a day, every day, all week, for months on end. And I still wasn't confident speaking.
Interesting. Well, I wonder, could you, we'll wait until after the break to read a little bit from the book. But in moving over there, now you had also, and again, in Making Peace, we explore this a lot, but you had also explored many different careers in your life. But basically, you gave up your career to move to Germany to be Marcus's wife. When you made that leap, you were very much in love and excited about marriage. But was there a point where it sort of hit you that you had given up a lot to make that move?
I expected it to be easier to assimilate there. And I thought, well, I'm a writer. You know, I had freelanced for magazines. I thought I could freelance for the same magazines I had been writing for. And then I got over there and they were all saying, well, we don't do international stories. So I just really hit a wall in terms of what I thought I could do. I did find a couple of little tiny projects doing writing press releases for a German bicycle company, and they needed them in English, and then we argued over the proper grammar, and I was like, I think I should win this argument, but that was challenging. I did give up a lot. I was so focused on trying to learn the language so that I could actually have a life there that became my job. So that's why everything else felt like it was falling to the wayside. I was right. Had to cook and clean and shop and
right. Yeah. And your purpose in life became learning German.
And my purpose became supporting him in his career. And I'm like, wait a second, how'd this happen? That was not something I believed in. I think every woman should have their own earning power and have their own, I don't know, passion and purpose outside of the home.
Right. And so when you moved to Germany, do you feel like there were cultural forces that also put you in that place? I mean, already you're at a disadvantage because you're in another country and you're not fluent in the language. And so you have to, you know, reinvent yourself. But did you feel like the culture also surrounding you was telling you that that was your place in the home taking care of Marcus?
Mainly the corporation, the people that work for that company. There seemed to be a very, well, it's an automotive company. It's very male dominated. There are women that work there in executive positions, but it's very, very chauvinistic. I think Germany is 50 years ahead of us in some ways and 50 years behind in others.
Fascinating. And of course, you didn't know that before you got there.
There's no way I could have known. And when I visited, I always had such a great time. I had met nice people. I, you know, enjoyed going to the restaurants and being around town. But when I moved there, it was just a whole other experience.
Fascinating. What about the people that you were in German class with? Where did they come from?
A lot of them were from politically troubled countries. They were seeking asylum or, you know, looking for a better way of life. Lots of people from Turkey, Syria, Poland,
so
Afghanistan.
People, right. There yeah. to learn the language and there to seek a new life, but not people who were similar to you.
I didn't meet any Americans in my classes.
Interesting. All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Beth Howard. Her latest book is Hausfrau Honeymoon, Love, Language, and Other Misadventures in Germany. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nubby. Coming up in a few minutes, I'm going to visit with Rich Foens. He is retiring after 71 years of repairing shoes. The last 35 years he spent at Smitty's Shoe Repair in Marion, Iowa, and he's closing his doors this week. We'll take a look back over his career. With me right now is Beth Howard, and many of you know a little bit about Beth Howard. She lived in the American Gothic house for a while and ran a pie stand, the Pitchfork pie stand, out of the house. Her memoir, Making Peace, a memoir of love, loss, and pie, was extremely popular and told the story of embracing pie as a way to move through grief. Now she's just released a book called Hausfrau Honeymoon, and that predates what happened in Making Peace. Hausfrau Honeymoon, Love, Language, and Other Misadventures in Germany. And Beth, just before the break, we were talking about culture shock when you moved to Germany. You and Marcus were very much in love. You got married. You moved there and found that really you were a housewife, which is something that your life had not prepared you to be. And you found that you really chafed under that yoke. Can you read a little bit from the book for us?
Sure.
This is a scene when my dad was visiting right after our wedding in Germany. My dad and I carry the groceries into the kitchen, a cheerful, bright orange-tiled room about the size of a sailboat galley. While there is a full-size stovetop range and oven, the refrigerator is the size of a hotel minibar. Though big enough to keep a bachelor's beer supply cool, it can't contain the food needed for two adults and a houseguest, which means frequent trips to Aldi, where Barbara works. In addition to a space-constrained refrigerator, we have a lack of kitchen cupboard space. But we're lucky to have cupboards at all, since when you move into a German apartment, all you get is a bare, raw shell. No built-in cupboards, no stove, oven, or refrigerator, not even a sink. But ours is a unique setup, because Herr Schindler normally rents out to single automotive executives who don't have the time, or the wife, to build out a kitchen. He rents the place with the cabinets and all the big appliances already installed. This includes the washing machine. After the flood, we brought our own. It has a sensor that stops the machine and the water flow if anything goes awry. We also took out renter's insurance. This place isn't really big enough for the two of you, is it? My dad asks as he watched me try to cram the cornflakes blocks into the cabinet. It's fine, I tell him, leaving the cornflakes on the counter. We're not home that much. The view is great, and it's so cheap we can spend extra money on traveling. I don't tell him about the washing machine incident and how badly I've wanted to find a new apartment ever since. You've done a good job with that little room you have, he adds. I like those closets you have in the bedroom. Yeah, we're keeping IKEA in business, I say. It's true. Europe's lack of built-in closets is why IKEA's founder, Ingvar Kamprad, was just ahead of Aldi's owners on Forbes' top 10 wealthiest individuals list. We did talk about looking for a bigger place, but you have to give 3 months' notice whenever you move, I continue. I just don't want to go through the hassles, especially knowing we're not going to be here that long. At least you'll be saving space in my address book, he says. Do you know how many pages I've used up because of you? I raise my eyebrows as if to say I have no clue, though it's a subject he brings up often. They were all good places, I say. He rattles the ice in the silver shaker and fills my glass. Here's your martini. I take the drink from my dad and slugging back a gulp. I sigh, feeling the gin and vodka travel down my throat. It burns so good. Here's to you, boo, he says, holding up his glass to mine. I have to hand it to you. You're doing great. I roll my eyes. Yeah, Dad, thanks. You can always come back to L.A., he adds. You know we miss you.
In that piece from Hausfrau Honeymoon, Beth, you refer to a couple of incidents that you write about also in the book. So tell me a little bit about the washing machine flood. What happened?
Oh, it was a front-loading machine, and it was an old one, and apparently I didn't have the door latched all the way. I'm sure I did. I'm very, careful about those kinds of things. But the landlord came and pounded on the door, and apparently his apartment was flooding downstairs because the door came open and the bathroom floor had flooded,
right,
and had seeped all the way down.
You thought you'd cleaned up all the water, but it had soaked through the tile.
And I was home alone. Marcus was at work, and I just got chewed out. And I was so upset that I snuck out of the apartment while the landlord was still in there, trying to get things fixed. And I, it was just, again, one of those things where, I didn't mean to do it, but they couldn't be nice about it. They couldn't accept my apology, or that, they couldn't even be kind. So that was painful. And then at Aldi, which I always tell this story because it's pretty funny, about they get mad if you don't lay your wine bottles down on the conveyor belt. Well, I didn't know, and I'm in line, and all of a sudden I'm getting shouted at by the cashier, and everyone's turning to stare at me like public humiliation. She's telling me in German, which I can't understand a word because she's screaming it so fast and loud, that I'm supposed to lay my bottles down. And then some very nice gentleman behind me gently says, she wants you to lay your bottles down. Well, why can't they just ask nicely?
Well, and that's a recurring pattern through, as you're trying to learn the rules of the culture that you are now part of, people correct you, but by shouting. That seemed to be the reaction of first defense in Germany.
And I complained to Marcus about it, and he goes, oh, well, we're just used to it. And I shout back, I don't want to get used to this. This is, you could be nice. You can say things nicely. I will be happy to lay my wine bottles. Ma'am, would you please lay your wine bottles down? But no.
So your dad, though, in coming over and saying, you can always come back to L.A., your mother was constantly saying you can always come back to L.A. Your dad was always saying it. You had friends back in Los Angeles saying it to you as well. Did that make it harder with people constantly reminding you could leave if you wanted to?
No, opposite. It made me want to try harder to make it work. I'm not going to quit. I'm not going to give up. I'm gonna make this work. I am going to do whatever it takes. And I stayed in school. I kept going to the classes. I got a part-time job at a coffee house. I was terrified. Like, what if I can't speak with the customers? But, you know, all you have to say is, you know, what would you like to drink? Here's right. your change. I tried a lot of different things. I found a yoga class, several. I tried many different yoga classes, in fact, to, you know, find one that might be a fit.
You found that the German instructor of your yoga class was also not averse to yelling at you for doing things wrong in
right?
yoga class.
And how ironic is that? You're in yoga. It's supposed to be, you know, the Zen space. And no, they yell at you in yoga. I even went to therapy over there. You know, I really wanted it to work. I wanted to conquer this challenge. I wanted to learn how to speak the language, and if not speak it fluently, at least speak it well enough to get by and have a life there, and make more friends, and have some kind of livelihood apart from, you know, working in the house. I did get an editing project from a friend in Seattle, so that kept me busy. I could do the work from Germany. And just, you know, via email. And so I would take my laptop down to a coffee house and I would work on editing my things. And that was helpful. That was a step forward.
So how did Marcus react when you shared your frustrations with the culture? I mean, this is where he grew up. He was very comfortable in this culture.
I know. And that's what I feel terrible about. You know, I'm sorry that I don't love that part about you. And I tried so hard to just be more understanding, and I was not very understanding, and I was not gentle with him either. And he would just shut down because he couldn't do anything about it. You know that I'm here to do this job and, you know, I'm providing for you. I got that line. I was like, no, that's not what I want. I want us to have an equal partnership in a place where we can both be happy. So I was really, really pushing him, and I pushed probably too hard. I just, you know, I look back and I don't know how I could have done it differently. Would I have still married him? Absolutely. Would I have moved over there and not had a job already lined up or so? I don't know. I would, of course, do it again. It's just that I look back and I go, I don't know how I could have done it any better or easier. Maybe if I had lived in Munich or Frankfurt, that would have been better, a more cosmopolitan city.
Stuttgart is a factory town, mainly.
Well, it's beautiful, and it's right on the edge of the Black Forest. It's got a lot of culture. It's got opera and symphony and all that. But it has a reputation of being more conservative. The accent is definitely, or it's a dialect. It's very hard to understand. It's not what they teach in school. So, you know, you come out after spending all these hours in the classroom, and then you don't understand a word on the street. So the language part in Stuttgart is hard, too.
I'm talking with Beth Howard. Her most recent memoir is Hausfrau, Honeymoon, Love, Language, and Other Misadventures in Germany. I'm curious, in retrospect, when you think about how isolated and frustrated you felt living in Germany, which is a country where almost everybody learns English in school. So even if you don't speak the language, there is this recourse. You can communicate with a lot of people in English. Think about how isolated you are. And now living in the United States, how does that change how you look at people who move here and have to learn English and try to assimilate to our culture?
Well, because I'd been traveling internationally since I was young and was always marveling at people and their ability to speak other languages and trying to be understood myself, that's made me so much more compassionate. For a long time, I've always been more patient, and I make a very big effort to speak more slowly, clearly. I want to help the people who don't speak English here understand me and speak in a way that's kind toward them. That's, you know, to be mm-hmm. generous of spirit and say, let me give you a helping hand here. Maybe I know a few words in their language, or maybe you just smile, but I think it's so important to be able to communicate. And yes, I mean, I know both sides.
Yeah. Well, and I think in reading your book, it made me think about how easy it is to understand
the sort of enclaves that people are drawn to, where, you know, some people look at a community of people from another country who, you know, tend to live in the same apartment building or the same neighborhood and socialize mostly with each other, go to a church where they, you know, worship in their own language, and think, well, why aren't they assimilating? But in reading your book, I mean, I can completely understand the allure of being able to find this community that feels comfortable and feels like home in a sea of so much that is foreign. I mean, it really made me look at those communities in a little bit different way.
I know. It makes my heart hurt just hearing you even say that, because it's so terrifying to be out there in another culture where you're not understood and you don't understand all the customs. And you're right. It doesn't feel like home. How do you make it feel more like home? You know, interestingly, I did not have a lot of American friends in Germany. I kind of, in a way, wanted to avoid them because I was really, I mean, my husband was German, so a lot of our friends and just were by default German. But I really wanted to assimilate. But, you know, again, looking at the American side of things, I do understand that. I do have compassion for that. And I do think it would be great if we could all make a bigger effort to be helpful.
This story starts like a fairy tale, but then it reads like a challenging marriage, which, you know, many of us can relate to. There are so many memoirs written about more of the fairy tale type experiences, about traveling abroad and finding yourself and falling in love. And, you know, we can think of several popular titles that fall into that category. In releasing this very real, very honest story that, again, is funny but painful, were you nervous about how people would respond to it?
Oh, my God, yes. And in fact, I barely told anybody I was publishing this because I was afraid that I was going to get hate mail or people just... I had some early readers say that they didn't like that it wasn't such a happy story. And they were disappointed because, you know, I had sort of canonized Marcus in Making Peace, I guess. And and they felt that maybe he wasn't living up to this image they had of, you know, this Prince Charming. And I'm like, no, this is the reality. And we did love each other. And we did work, both of us worked very hard to make this marriage work. And I think it's healthy to be honest. I think we can all learn from that and not put ourselves, compare ourselves to others like, oh, she had it so easy. How come I can't make it work? I think it's important to be very candid and show that, hey, we did still make it work as best we could, given the circumstances. Right. We really did succeed, I think, in a way. But maybe not the way you would hope.
Maybe you know? Not the way you hoped.
Well, of course not. You know, yeah. I got married at 40 and I thought this was going to be the be all end all. Finally, at last. And then, oh, my God, it was definitely not what I expected. But I'm still so grateful for the experience. I'm glad to have had that love. And I'm sorry that he's gone.
So you were nervous about people reading it. How have people reacted? I know it hasn't been out very long, only the first of the month, but you've had people dig into this memoir. How are people responding?
I am so happy to say that they like it. I'm loving your book. Or people are like, they are so excited. They have to email me when I'm halfway through, but I just had to tell you how much I'm enjoying your book. I think it's kind of a light read. It's certainly not the grief-laden memoir of Making Peace. There's no grief in it. It's just my own personal grief of not being able to speak German. It's sort of light. It's sort of funny. It's the other thing that people have told me, which I really appreciate hearing, is reading your book took me out of my current reality and transported me somewhere else. You know, I really felt like I was there with you. And that's a huge compliment, of course. And even for me reading it, I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, I hope people don't feel like I'm bashing on Germany too badly. But after reading it, I was like, I would love to go back. It makes me want to go back to Germany, not to live there, but I would love to go back. There's so many things I miss about it. So many good things.
So now, with the perspective that you have of the years that have gone by, the other experiences that you've had, what do you think you really learned? Not so much as a woman and a partner, but culturally, what do you think you learned about not just Germany, but about that kind of international travel and how our cultures shape us?
I have an even bigger worldview than I had before. I have a Germany is more. I have Europe even is more in context to me when I listen to the news. I have a much better understanding of what's going on when you hear a news story, especially the compassion for the immigration stuff going on. I mean, I get it. I've seen it. People are trying to live a better, safer, healthier life, and I think Germany's just really tried hard to, I hate to say it, but, you know, make up for some of their darker times, and they've really been lending a helping hand. Anyway, just again, just perspective, context, really a better understanding of the world in general.
And I get the sense that before you moved to Germany, maybe you didn't have a deep understanding of how American you were. Do you feel like you felt more American because of this experience?
I thought I was so worldly and open. And I don't know. I mean, if you saw me running around Stuttgart in my lederhosen, you know, you're like, oh, she's really adapting. I don't know. I missed the California lifestyle. That's where I had been living most of my, I guess you could say, my adult life. I missed the sort of more relaxed, casual. I mean, California, even compared to Iowa, is more relaxed, more casual, more laid back. So I did miss that part of it.
Well, Beth, we are out of time, but thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It's Hausfrau Honeymoon, Love, Language, and Other Misadventures in Germany. My guest is Beth Howard. We'll continue in just a moment with Talk of Iowa. I'll be talking to a cobbler who is retiring after 71 years. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Rich Foen started learning the shoe repair business from his dad when he was 9 years old. Later, he owned his own shop in Tipton for 25 years, and he's been the proprietor of Smitty's Shoe Repair in Marion for the last 35 years. Now, at age 80, he's decided to close his doors this week, and he is with me on the telephone. Hello, Rich.
Hello.
Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Sure.
I want to go back to when you were 9 years old and you started learning this craft from your dad. You are a third-generation cobbler, right?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your grandparents and their role in the shoe business.
Well, I had a grandfather that designed shoes for Krentler Brothers' last company, and then I had a grandmother that worked for Brown Shoe Factory in St. Louis, and so did my mother. And I have an uncle that was the buyer for Boyd's men's shoe department in St. Louis. And at that time, it was the largest exclusive men's department store in the country.
Wow. So, and your dad had a shoe repair business when you were growing up.
Yeah, my dad and my uncle both had shops in Davenport.
Wow.
And then my uncle moved to Tipton, and in 58, we moved to Tipton, and I had a shop there, and I was there for 25 years.
When you started learning the business, did you feel pressure to grow up and go into the family business?
No, not at all. My dad, who I'm sure is very proud of what I've accomplished and what I've done over the years, and it's been we just made a nice living out of it, and we've enjoyed every day of it. So
you have described this as a hobby that you've been able to make a living out of. When you fell in love with shoe repair, what was it about shoe repair that made you want to spend your days doing it?
I think that I enjoyed the work, but most of all, I enjoyed the customers and the people, and having been able to repair their shoes and do it so that they were satisfied and I was satisfied, and it made kind of a happy marriage.
Can you describe a little bit of the process that you enjoy? Because clearly you've been doing this a very long time. You're very good at it. What kinds of things do you do that you really love doing?
Well, I just enjoy all aspects of the shoe repair, but like I think that the best thing of it is if I've made the customer happy, then they've made me happy. And that's the way it goes. So,
you've also repaired a lot of baseball gloves over the years. That must be pretty rewarding.
That's something that I kind of do that I enjoy doing too. So it's kind of I can sit home in my recliner and do that while I'm there. So
the shoe repair business has changed a lot over the years. When you were growing up in Davenport, you told the Cedar Rapids Gazette that there were 13 shoe repair shops downtown that you can remember.
Yes, that's true. People don't realize that at the time, but because of the way things are today, there's not that many shops. But like I say, there were five shops in our block.
Five shops just in your block. So as you got older, you really watched those shops disappear. Can you tell me what you've seen change over the years?
Well, first of all, the people are getting older and retiring and dying off, and there's no young people that has taken up the trade. So,
why do you think that is?
It's just a different type of society where people want guarantees and benefits, and the only guarantees that you've got in a shoe repair shop is what you earn and what you do.
Well, and people's relationship with their shoes has changed pretty dramatically too,
yeah.
Right? So how do you think that's changed?
Well, I think that the big thing is the shoe factories are being more and more apt to making shoes that are not repairable because they don't want you to spend the money to repair them. They want to sell you new ones.
Have you had people bring you shoes that they wanted you to repair that you just can't because of the way
yep.
they're constructed?
Yep, that's for sure. We see more and more of that every day.
Really? What kinds of things make it impossible to repair shoes?
They put on plastic soles.
So the molded plastic soles
yeah.
are just
yeah.
impossible to replace
yep.
or repair.
Yep, that's for sure.
Now, given that it's been harder for people to repair new shoes, that a lot more people are treating their shoes like they're disposable objects. Have you had a hard time getting the equipment that you need to repair shoes?
Well, no, I've had my equipment for some time, and of course I can't do anything in the molded stuff because that's put together with heat, and we can't do that. But we've been able to have sole and put heels on and things like that on good quality shoes. So.
I think I read again in that profile in the Cedar Rapids Gazette that some of your equipment is 100 years old.
Well, close to it, I think.
So how do you repair that equipment if things go wrong? I can't imagine the factory's still helping you out.
Well, you kind of have to be your own mechanic and figure out what's wrong and fix it and go from there. So,
how would you describe your relationship with your customers over the years? I understand that you've had a very loyal clientele.
Yeah, it's been great. Like I say, I've got loyal customers from all over, and right now I've got a couple of people that came up to see me from Tipton that I've known for 60 years. So, like I say, it's a great marriage as far as the customer relationship and being able to get along with them.
So you've had people driving a long way just to bring you their shoes as cobblers have become rare.
Yeah, I get people from Cedar Falls and Waterloo and Waverly, Clinton, Dubuque, Burlington, Iowa City, Cedar Rapids, Maquoketa.
Wow.
I get them from all over.
And there's at least one customer who's been mailing you her shoes from Seattle, right?
That's right. She's been a customer of mine for about over 30 years.
What do you think those people are going to do when you close your doors?
Well, hopefully they can find somebody else that can take care of their problems. And apparently I have a person that is interested in buying my machinery, and they plan on opening a shop in Cedar Rapids, which is a lot closer.
Yeah, that's really good news. If that didn't happen, do you know where the closest cobbler is at this point?
Belle Plaine and Muscatine.
Wow. All right. So people are going to have to drive a long way to get their shoes fixed.
Hopefully in a short time there's going to be a shop opening in Cedar Rapids. I'll know more about it probably at the end of this week.
As you have been in this business for so long and you've seen fewer and fewer people go into the business, are you worried that this craft will disappear entirely?
No. No, there's always going to be a need for it. So it's just a matter of somebody that has, it's a passion to do it, and they want to do it, and because of not actually they make a living, but just to make customers satisfied. And like with me, if I make a customer satisfied, that's gratitude enough for me.
How do you think people would learn to be a cobbler these days? You learned right by your father's side.
Well, that's it. You would have to get trained by somebody that's got an established shop. There used to be schools that you could go to, but they all have since closed. So.
Wow. So you just have to apprentice yourself somehow.
Yep.
What are you going to do when you close your doors?
I'm going to take a couple of months off to see if I can get my body healed up a little better, and then I'm going to refinish furniture, my own furniture. I'm not taking on a commercial business.
All right. So that just seems like the next hobby for you?
Yep, that's for sure.
Why do you want to do that? What excites you about that?
I've done some refinishing in the past, and it's something that I enjoy doing, and I can do it at my own pace. If I want to work an hour or two a day, fine. If I don't want to work at all, I won't have to.
Now, I'm getting the impression that you've had some health problems. Is that what made you decide that now is the time to close the shop?
No. I had planned on retiring in June because of my age and some of my health problems. But the big thing of it is I lost my lease here in the store, and the Masonic Lodge owns the building, and they have other plans for it, but they have bent over backwards to try to make the transition as easy and comfortable as possible, and I really appreciate their help and assistance with making this transition.
So moving and starting over at age 80 would have been incredibly challenging.
Yeah, no, that was not even an option. I figured I was close to retirement anyhow, and I just pushed it up a few months.
Have you thought about retiring over the years? I mean, a lot of people don't work until they're 80, Rich.
Well, I've thought about it a lot, but my head says I can still do this. But like I say, my body says you're nuts.
What made you want to keep doing it those years? Nobody would have criticized you for taking retirement a few years ago.
It's because I enjoy the customers and the people and the good friends that I've met over the years. So,
are you worried about that in retirement? Are you worried about not seeing people as much?
That's the biggest thing. Am I going to miss the work? No. But I am going to miss the daily contact with the good friends and customers I've had over the years.
Well, I hope you find a way to connect with those people. So you're planning on naps, you're planning on a little bit of refinishing furniture. What else are you hoping to do in retirement?
Just enjoy.
Just enjoy. You've got 5 grandkids, is that what I read?
Yep.
So you're hoping to spend a little bit of time with the grandkids. And I also read that over the years you've been repairing the equipment for the Marion Fire Department as a volunteer service. I'm curious about that. What about being a cobbler prepares you to repair equipment for firemen?
Well, it's mostly sewing up their bags and gear and putting snaps on their bunker gear and things like that. And I always felt that I would do this as service to the community. I would rather see them spend their money on equipment and repair, you know, and training and things like that, which is important to them. And like I say, I've always done this just because it's helping the community.
Well, it sounds like you've made a real difference in your community, in Marion, over the last 35 years. How do you think about your place in the community? You've been a pretty important guy.
Well, I I think that with the clientele that I got from all over around the area, these people are not going to drive 90-100 mile round trip just to bring in a pair of shoes. They're going to stop at the grocery store. They're going to stop and have lunch. They're going to buy gas. They're going to shop at several different places. So it's a big economic ripple effect for the whole community.
How have people reacted to your news that you're retiring? What are you hearing from some of your longtime customers?
They're not very happy. They're happy that I'm retiring, but they're not very happy. They don't have a quality shoe repair shop that they can go to at this particular time.
And I know that you're not taking on any more shoes right now. You've got to finish up what you have in the shop. Did you have a flurry of people bringing in last-minute things saying, hey, you've got to repair this before you close your doors?
That's one of the reasons why I didn't announce this too early, because I knew that was what was going to happen. So I made up my mind to notice people there, let them know that I was going to retire on the 1st of November. That way I'm not taking any work in. And so they just, you know, if I would have not announced it, I would still be taking.
Right.
Yeah, so.
And so do you have quite a few projects to finish in the next couple of days?
I got some, not a whole lot, because I quit taking work in last Monday, so I just got some finishing up to do, and of course I've got to get some machinery cleaned up and ready to sell and things like that too. So,
did you repair any of your shoes in the last few weeks to prepare for retirement?
My shoes, no. My wife's shoes, yes.
So.
In fact, I was sent to work this morning with a pair of hers, and I told her, I said, you ought to read this sign up here at the store, but I'm going to try to make life less miserable at home.
I think that's a very good plan. I think an exception for your wife is probably...
Not that it's miserable at all.
No.
We're married 57 years, and we've had a good life together.
Has she been encouraging you to retire?
We haven't talked about it much, so I will now become her problem.
I'm sure you won't be a problem. Do you and she have some plans for after you take some naps and relax a little bit? Some exciting plans?
We're not really much into travel or things like that, but there are some things that we'd like to accomplish yet. So,
well, I'm excited for both of you. And Rich, what do you think you'll miss the most?
The people, without a question. Will I miss the work? No. I'll miss all the good customers and the people that I've had over the years.
Well, and I'm sure that they'll miss you too, and hopefully they'll seek you out. Hopefully you'll be able to maintain a few of those connections.
Okay.
Well, thanks for doing what you do, Rich, and best of luck to you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Rich Foen started learning the shoe repair business from his dad when he was 9 years old. That was 71 years ago. Later on, he owned his own shoe repair shop in Tipton for 25 years, and he's been the proprietor of Smitty's Shoe Repair in Marion for the last 35 years. And now, at age 80, he's decided to close his doors. He's retiring on November 1st. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. We had production assistance today from Dean Borg. We also had production assistance today from Alyssa Bovinette. You can get in touch with us anytime. We'd love to hear from you. And you can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.